You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of The Law Report. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to The Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. This evening we travel to Africa. We look at the growing controversy surrounding an Australian company which operates a mine near the town of Kilwa in the Congo.
What happened was that in October of last year, there was a small-scale rebellion which caused the interruption of operations at a mine which was run by Australian company Anvil Mining. As far as we know, the mining company evacuated its employees on planes that it had chartered, and the Congolese army returned on those same planes and then took vehicles owned by the company and committed atrocities against the local civilian population.
Now lawyers are looking at whether the company could be complicit in the massacre of up to 100 people. That's later. But first to Zimbabwe, where a comprehensive campaign to undermine the justice system has helped pave the way for the widespread demolition of urban housing, a policy which has left 700,000 of the country's poorest people homeless. MCs, producers, DJs, radio presenters, sponsors na distributors. Ndani ya hii game tuko ngapi? Wangapi wa kweli? Wangapi matapeli? Tunapotoka mbali, tunapokwenda mbali. In a recent report, the United Nations has slammed the Mugabe regime's so-called Clean Out the Rubbish campaign, describing the eviction and demolition of urban shanty towns and informal businesses as a catastrophic injustice. The Zimbabwean opposition says the campaign has nothing to do with concerns about sanitation or crime prevention. Rather, it's a direct payback on the urban poor for having voted against Mugabe at the last election. Prominent lawyer David Coltart is the opposition justice minister. He says the demolitions, the ongoing seizure of white-owned farms, the destruction of the free press and the collapse of democracy have been made possible partly because the Mugabe government has been highly effective in undermining the independence of the courts, which in the 1980s were well regarded internationally. David Coltart told me that there's little semblance of an effective and independent rule of law in today's Zimbabwe.
Well, we have all the form of rule of law, but very little substance. We see a judicial system that has been completely subverted. It has been turned on its head. The police are not there to protect the rights of people. We see selective prosecutions brought by the police and the Attorney General, and there's absolutely no fairness before the courts.
Can you give me some recent examples? I guess what comes to mind most obviously is the raising of urban slums, colloquially called removing the rubbish.
Yes, Operation Murambatsvina, translated as remove the rubbish, has graphically illustrated what I've just discussed. We've got a variety of laws in Zimbabwe that govern what should happen when there are illegal structures. Let me stress as well that many of these structures were not illegal, but let's assume that they all were. The Regional Town and Country Planning Act, the Urban Council Act, and the Housing Standards Act all state that where there is an illegal structure, the occupant of that structure must be given personal notice that the structure is illegal and should be given a period of a month to remedy it or to vacate it before it is demolished. And the law also says that the local authority is the institution that should proceed with the demolition. That hasn't happened in Zimbabwe. Local councils, which are controlled by the opposition, haven't even been consulted. The police in some instances has moved in without any notice whatsoever with bulldozers and just bulldozed some of these homes to the ground. And people have had absolutely no recourse to the courts. When they've tried to go to the courts, in one particular case, the courts have ignored these statutes in a brazen example of how they side with the regime, which is pursuing a political objective.
Well, why are the courts ignoring the statutes which are on the books? Why has it come to this point?
Sadly, in the course of the last 5 years, the judiciary has been completely subverted. The Mugabe regime has used its acquisition of commercial farms to subvert the judiciary. Many judges have received farms and have in that way become complicit with this regime.
You're telling me that the judges have been handed formerly white-owned farms?
Yes, judges, including the Chief Justice, have been handed farms that have been, in many cases, unlawfully seized from their former owners. Not just small holdings. Some of them are highly sophisticated businesses. And in some cases, these judges don't even attend to their duties. In one particular case, this judge is hardly ever in the High Court because he's busy farming. So you'll see that the judiciary has been very seriously subverted through this.
And I understand that those judges who've refused to come to the party have been severely punished. Several have even been driven into exile. Tell me about some of the more prominent cases. For instance, who is Judge Fergus Blackie?
Well, Fergus Blackie is a judge first appointed by Robert Mugabe in the mid-1980s. He served as a High Court judge, and I stress appointed by Robert Mugabe, until he was pretty much hounded out of office a few years ago.
Why was he handed out of office?
Well, he was outspoken. He was one of the independent judges. And the final straw was when he found that the still Minister of Justice was in contempt of the High Court. And that inflamed the passions of not just the Minister of Justice, but also others in government. And they then embarked on a campaign of retribution.
And there's another judge, Justice Michael Majuru. Tell me about him.
Michael Majuru was an administrative court judge. Our administrative court presides over land matters and also general administrative law matters. He handed down a judgment in relation to an application brought by an independent newspaper for an operational license. And he ruled in their favour, and was then subjected to a barrage of abuse in the government-controlled press and was threatened by the government. He feared for his life and is now in exile.
How do the courts operate under these kinds of pressures? I mean, do people just buckle, as these judges do, and walk out and leave?
Well, not all of them do. Highest court is called the Supreme Court of Zimbabwe. We have one judge left there who is a remnant of the previous Supreme Court, Justice Wilson Sandura, very brave and courageous and principled man. But he is only one judge of six Supreme Court judges. You'll find a similar percentage in the High Court. There are a few remaining independent judges left over. And there are more at the lowest level of courts than in the magistracy. But the vast majority of our High Court judges, unfortunately, now appear to owe their allegiances to the regime, and one simply doesn't get justice on any politically related case.
When we're talking about the corruption or the corrosion of public institutions which contribute to a collapsing of the rule of law, we have to look not only at the judiciary but also at the police and at the Attorney General's Department and a whole range of other institutions.
Oh, absolutely, and Parliament as well. Parliament in the last 5 years has subverted our laws. We've seen the promulgation of statutes that are draconian, indeed I would term them fascist. For example, we've got the Public Order and Security Act, which requires political parties to seek police permission prior to holding meetings, and the police are given very wide powers to ban those meetings. The so-called Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act is an act designed to cut down on the freedom of the media and has been used to effectively ban the daily newspaper, an independent daily with the largest circulation in Zimbabwe. And so we see that law itself, Parliament itself, has been subverted, turned on its head. And law, far from being used as an instrument to protect human rights, is used as an instrument to suppress Zimbabweans' human rights.
Now, as I understand it, not only is legislation being amended, there's now serious talk about the Mugabe regime amending the constitution, the sort of the core document which spells out everybody's rights and responsibilities. What's being proposed, and what do you think about those proposals?
This is a matter of deep concern. In March this year, through chicanery and abuse of the electoral process, the Mugabe regime has effectively secured a two-thirds majority in parliament, which it needs to amend Zimbabwe's constitution. In particular, they say that they're going to introduce a Senate, which the country can ill afford at present. I haven't seen the details of the amendments, but there is some discussion that the executive is going to be given powers to appoint members to the Senate, that it won't even be done through a democratic process. And in a very disturbing development, they say that they are now going to attempt to nationalize land that has been identified for resettlement. And by that, they mean all the land acquired from predominantly white commercial farmers. They've been deeply frustrated in that, despite all the flaws in the legal system, lawyers and farmers' organizations have taken a variety of constitutional points and have delayed the process in attempts to protect farmers' rights. And very few of these land cases have been resolved, to the great embarrassment and frustration of the regime.
Even though, if the cases are heard, it's more than likely that the judges will come down in the government's favour.
Yes, absolutely. For example, I was involved in a constitutional test case earlier on this year before the Supreme Court. And quite frankly, it was unanswerable. What the Supreme Court has done in that case is it was argued in March, and we still don't have a judgment. This is an urgent application brought to the Supreme Court in terms of our Declaration of Rights, and it still hasn't been adjudicated on. Now we've got this constitutional amendment which seeks to nationalise everything and drive a horse and carriage through all the rights that farmers had in an attempt to bring this whole process to an end.
In other words, don't even bother coming to the courts. Don't waste our time with these cases which have delayed, if not stopped, the process of farm expropriation.
That's all that has happened. You're absolutely correct. All that we've done is delay the process and expose the cavalier way in which subordinate legislation, such as the Land Acquisition Act, has been dealt with in Parliament.
Now, I know that you're both a politician and a lawyer, and I understand that many opposition politicians have died as a result of opposing the government. Tell me, what are the kinds of pressures put upon lawyers who bring actions against the government?
Well, lawyers are not immune at all. Lawyers have been detained and assaulted and tortured. Gabriel Shumba, a relatively young lawyer who, in a particularly bold way, represented opposition politicians in Harare, the capital, was tortured and is now in exile. Beatrice Mtetwa, who won the IBA Human Rights Lawyer of the Year Award a couple of years back, a woman lawyer, I stress, was assaulted by the police. I have been detained. My house has been searched. I have survived an assassination attempt. So lawyers who stand up are subjected to very similar abuse to members of other professions and the public.
I understand that something like 6 opposition MPs have died or been tortured and killed.
Of the 57 opposition MPs who were elected to Parliament in June 2000, 6 died by the end of that 5-year term in March this year, as a direct or indirect result of torture or other unlawful conduct perpetrated by state agents.
Politicians and lawyers are people who are relatively well-resourced, and presumably that would provide some protection from being susceptible to government pressure, but of course ordinary Zimbabweans are far, far worse off.
Oh, absolutely. Tens of thousands of Zimbabweans in the last 5 years have been tortured, have been assaulted, have been deprived of food, have been subjected to all sorts of other indignities and violation of their rights.
Lawyer and politician David Coltart, the Shadow Justice Minister of Zimbabwe, a white MP whose electorate is in an overwhelmingly black area of Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second largest city. I'm Damien Carrick, and you're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and now available for download on your iPod. Pharaon Castro, plus costaud, commandant costaud, comme les piles du Racel. Dans le rap et comme le sel, nautique comme Steve Stible et universel. Now, you may have seen a few weeks ago a Four Corners program on ABC TV that reported on the bloody and brutal suppression of a small civil uprising involving about 20 rebels, some wearing sandals, that took place in October last year in the town of Kilwa in the Congo. The rebellion was brutally quashed by the Congolese military, who killed up to 100 villagers. Four Corners explored the role of an Australian company in the massacre. Perth-based Anvil Mining operates a highly lucrative copper mine nearby, whose operations were disrupted by the small rebellion. Richard Meeran's a special counsel with Slater and Gordon. Acting on instructions of a number of human rights groups, he recently submitted a complaint to the Australian Federal Police, calling on them to investigate the events in October last year.
As far as we know, the mining company evacuated its employees on planes that it had chartered, and the Congolese army returned on those same planes to Kilwa and then took vehicles owned by the company and committed atrocities against the local civilian population. The conduct of the Congolese military is a matter of record. It's been well documented for a number of years that they have been involved in committing atrocities against civilians. And when they knew they were coming, the local population ran away. A number of them, unfortunately, were captured. Some of them were beaten and tortured. We understand from investigations that there were some rapes that occurred. But in addition to that, a number of people were taken to a place by the military and shot and buried there. According to the local UN group, which conducted an investigation afterwards, between 30 and 100 people were summarily executed, and a number of other people were tortured and subjected to other kinds of violations.
So what involvement do you say Anvil, the mining company, had with the events of October 2004?
Well, what we know, and I don't think there's any dispute about this, is that the military came in to Kilwa in planes that had been chartered by Anvil Mining, for other purposes, no doubt, but that's how they came in. And that whilst they were in the town, they used vehicles that belonged to Anvil Mining. Now, this is important because the geographical isolation of Kilwa meant that it would have been very difficult without the provision of transport facilities for the Congolese military to have done this. What we don't know and what remains to be seen is the precise circumstances under which these vehicles were provided and this transport was provided.
Now, you believe that Anvil has some responsibility for what occurred. I understand that you've actually submitted a complaint to the Australian Federal Police. What are you arguing? What have you said to the Australian Federal Police, and what would you want them to do with this information?
Well, I've been instructed by human rights organisations, two in the Congo, one in the UK called RAID, and also the Human Rights Council of Australia, to file a complaint with the Australian Federal Police requesting them to investigate whether or not certain human rights violations, crimes against humanity and war crimes, may have been committed by Anvil in relation to this massacre in October of last year. So I'm not in a position at this stage, certainly, to say that crimes have been committed or that Anvil is necessarily responsible. As I indicated earlier, it does depend on the precise circumstances under which these vehicles were given to the Congolese military.
But you'd be arguing that if those circumstances do exist, that there could be scope for a prosecution under Australian law in Australian courts for what took place in faraway eastern Congo?
Certainly. As a result of certain amendments to the criminal code in Australia, which were introduced as a result of the Rome Statute on the International Criminal Court, it is now a criminal offence under Australian national law for an Australian national to commit war crimes or crimes against humanity, even where those offences have occurred overseas. So it is a criminal offence here in Australia for those types of offences to be committed by an Australian resident in another country.
In order for any prosecution to proceed, of course, that will turn on the exact circumstances of what took place back in Kilwa in October 2004. I understand that initially in an interview with ABC TV's Four Corners, Anvil's head said the use of the vehicles was provided at the request from the military of a legitimate country, a government of the country. But in a recent press release, Anvil gave a statement to the Stock Exchange that they now say that the vehicles were commandeered. If that's the case, that would indicate that they didn't really have any choice in how the vehicles were used or any say in how the vehicles were used.
That's exactly right. If indeed the vehicles were taken by force and they had no choice in the matter, then probably no offence would have been committed. But you've pointed to the inconsistency in the statements that have been made by the company. This suggestion that vehicles were commandeered has only emerged recently. It wasn't something that was said by Anvil at the time. It's never been mentioned before. But as you say, if it turns out that that is what happened, then probably that will be the end of the matter. Now, I think another point that I should clarify is that obviously we're not saying, or it's not being suggested, that Anvil might have committed these atrocities themselves as the principal offender. But under the relevant legislation, it is also an offence to aid and abet, counsel, or procure the commission of offence. So in this instance, what we are asking the AFP to look into specifically is whether an offence of aiding and abetting, counselling or procuring an offence by the Congolese military was committed by Anvil Mining.
Let's talk, Richard Meera, let's talk more generally about multinationals operating in developing countries. The Congo, as I understand it, is very much a war-ravaged country which has endured decades of misrule and more recently a ferocious civil war. What does the Kilwa massacre say to us about the broader implications of Australian companies who operate in countries like the Congo, where there are concerns about human rights and indeed economic exploitation?
Well, companies are in a difficult position when they operate in conflict zones like that. And I think the importance of the companies themselves observing some respect for human rights is much greater in this type of situation. Companies in this position have the potential to influence what happens in these countries. For instance, if Anvil Mining was to say to the Congolese military, if you want us to continue investing in your country and operating this mine, then you need to be more attentive to international human rights obligations than has so far been the case, then that might make a difference. And I think all companies that operate in these areas have an obligation, at least a moral obligation, to use their influence in that manner. There is a growing recognition amongst multinational companies that they have a function as good corporate citizens.
Of course, the whole kind of Anvil situation, it isn't a black and white story. I mean, it could be argued that companies such as Anvil, in operating such ventures, contribute to the wealth and health of the area where they are operating. I mean, I understand that in that region of Southeast Congo, there have been improvements in health and infrastructure, and there have been benefits from employment. And I understand that even something like 10% of the profits from the mine are being ploughed back into the community in all sorts of sort of development projects. I mean, companies like Anvil are contributing, aren't they?
I don't dispute that at all. I think it's important for developing countries to benefit from foreign investment and from the investment of multinational companies. I don't dispute that for one moment. I can't comment on exactly what Anvil may or may not be contributing to this particular community, but I don't dispute that. The only point I'm making is that when they do operate in these countries, that they need to bear in mind their moral and possibly legal obligations to respect human rights and international human rights standards.
Richard Meeran, who recently moved to Australia from London, where he had worked for many years on civil litigation involving foreign companies in Africa. His most famous case involved an issue that Australians are all too familiar with.
Well, that's a case that I was working on for several years, involving 7,500 South African asbestos miners who were employed in some of the most atrocious conditions in the mines of a British-owned company over quite a long period of time. Large numbers of them developed mesothelioma, which is a fatal cancer of the lining of the lungs associated with asbestos, and many others developed asbestosis. And I think the important feature was that this company was operating in a manner that simply wouldn't have been permitted in the UK or in any Western country. For instance, about 6% of the people we represented were employed in mines under the age of 7 years old without any respiratory protection whatsoever in very, very hazardous conditions. And this was during a period when the hazards of asbestos were well known. We had a report from a South African government inspector that children had been found encased in sacks of asbestos, being beaten with whips to make them work harder. So the asbestos issue is very much a very serious issue all around the world, including in Australia. But I think the conditions that South African asbestos workers were employed under were really unparalleled because the companies were able to get away with it under the past regime.
Where did you bring your court action? In what jurisdiction?
Well, that was a case that was brought in England because the parent company was an English company. That was important that we were able to do that because certainly at that time it would not have been possible to bring a case like that in South Africa. In 2003, the case was settled, and following that, compensation was paid to the claimants.
Mm. Now, you're currently involved in another case involving South African miners. Can you briefly tell me about that?
That's a group of test cases on behalf of silicosis victims who worked in South African gold mines. The number of silicosis victims from gold mines in South Africa is thought to be anything between 50,000 and 500,000.
How do you contract silicosis?
By excessive exposure to silica dust, which is the main type of dust in a gold mine. And again, because of the history of South Africa, workers in these gold mines were exposed to very high dust levels, largely unprotected for many, many years. And in fact, the dust limits in the gold mines were based on the assumption that 15% of the workforce employed for 20 years or more would develop silicosis.
Now, presumably the conditions which gave rise to the asbestos case and also the gold miners case in South Africa, they're now historical in the sense that companies no longer operate in those ways. But presumably around the world at the moment, there are a lot of cases involving multinationals and current practices. Can you tell me about some of those?
There are many, many cases, not just in the area of mining, but in the chemical industry and other industries too. And I think that this highlights the twofold purpose of these types of actions. One, obviously, is to compensate people who have been injured and to hold the companies accountable for having caused those injuries. But the other equally important reason for bringing these cases is the deterrent value that they bring. Because a company which has to participate in an expensive legal action and compensate its workers is going to think twice before doing the same thing again. And for us, I think that principle of deterrence is an important reason for doing these cases.
Richard Meeran, Special Counsel with Slater and Gordon. I did, of course, approach Anvil Mining for its views. I was informed that Anvil CEO Bill Turner is currently in Canada and unavailable for an interview. That's the Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and technical producer Brendan O'Neill. And don't forget, the Law Report, along with the other 830s, has entered the age of podcasting. The Law Report is now available for downloading at abc.net.au/rn/podcasting whenever and wherever is convenient for you. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.